This is the Venerable Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Seminar entitled Bodhacharya Vitara, held at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. This is talk number 1, June 12, 1980. This is an ARP digital remaster made January 2008.
Good evening once again to this inauguration of the President's course at Naropa Institute. It's my honor to introduce the two teachers of this course. Gentleman on the stage is the Venerable Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the president of Naropa Institute. He came to the United States in 1970 after Buddhism was basically made impossible in his native homeland of Tibet, and began teaching a small group of students the fundamental Buddhist teachings, which are the practice of meditation and relating directly to one's mind and one's experience without hope and fear. Gradually, students gathered around him more and more, and it became obvious that the Buddhist teachings were applicable not just in meditation practice and in a person's individual life, but they had implications beyond that for our lives as Americans in this country. In the course of the last 10 years, he and his students have established a religious organization named Vajradhatu, which has meditation centers around the country and has its capital in Boulder, Colorado, and also a secular educational foundation known as Nalanda Foundation, which has under its aegis Naropa Institute as its main project, but also a number of other projects, including an elementary school, a preschool, Shambhala training, and ideas of extending beyond that in terms of relating to Americans and their form of life. The basic teachings of the Mahayana and Vajrayana in Tibet are based on kindness and truth. Kindness is karuna, compassion, and truth is the simply things as they are. And Rinpoche founded Naropa Institute on those two principles, and it lives by virtue of the mutual warmth and communication of the whole community and the truthfulness of what we do. And this course is an exploration of those topics in a very traditional format, the Bodhicharya Avatara of the famous Mahayanist author Shantideva. So I'd like to welcome all of you again to this course and introduce Rinpoche.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, this particular year that we have a study session on the basic Buddhist teachings presented by myself and my regent, which we will be alternating in terms of the talks, as you might know already. The Institute is open to studying greater level of any form of discipline that is valid and ancient, has its ancient background, and we try to practice and study that particular way that we have psychology, arts, Buddhism, and a lot of other things. And this particular course is being one of the points where we study and trying to practice Buddhism, which is part of our study program. That the Naropa Institute tried to expand its vision as far as it could in not purely becoming a Buddhist alone, but we tried to expand greater level. And I think even the presentation of Buddhism here will give you some idea of the broad base that how and why and in which way that Buddhism would be helpful and effective to that particular vision. This particular course is based on the teachings of Shantideva, who is a medieval Indian saint who presented this particular teachings of how to practice Buddhism. And the title of this particular book is known as Bodhicaryavatara, which literally means entering into the actions of Bodhisattva, or the entering into the actions of enlightened one, enlightened mind. That seemed to be the theme. We are going to study and discuss in this particular session. And tonight I would like to make a general outline of the whole thing. Of basically why Buddhism at all. We have further education process at this point of realizing that Buddhism is a non-theistic religion or tradition. Which makes it unique. Whereas the other traditions are theistic in nature. That is to say that their traditions have a particular god or gods to worship. And their creation is the basis of the practice altogether. So we have a Hinduism Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu are the gods that creator, destroyer, and also maintenance of the world principle. And they are clearly regarded as external. Although, obviously, in mystical traditions, they might be regarded as a reflection of one's mind, but nonetheless, it's a theism. And then we have a Judeo-Christian tradition of Jehovah principle altogether. That particular point of view is also regarded as that there is a definitely external agent to save you from misery and uplift yourself as one with divine vision. However, we could find that in all of the mystical traditions of Judeo-Christian traditions, which also includes the Sufism of the Islamic traditions as well, which worships the same God, Jehovah, a different manifestation, agent by the particular founder. That we find that some traditions of theism talks about that in order to become a divine-like being, one needs a ladder or staircase or communicator. And some other traditions would say that you have a direct access to the divine principle. But nonetheless, both of the traditions have their basis on in experiencing definitely external, how deep and how mystical you could be, but still there is a touch of that is the basis on the idea of this and that, I and other. Either you worship Mohammedan or Christ, or you don't worship any intermediary persons. In the Hindu tradition, it's a direct link with the gods. In the Judaic tradition is a direct lineage that if you communicate with a god, it's a direct path. Nonetheless, that there is that notion of this person is communicating to that. You could go to the highest of the mystical traditions. The highest of the Gnostic traditions you could go, but still there's reference of a journey back and forth. And the purpose of all is to be seem to be based on idea of preservation of oneself. Even if we might talk in terms of selfless actions, but nonetheless selfless actions resulting confirmation from the divinities of all some kind has been presented. And if you read such as like Meister Eckhart's writings, at the time he was regarded as a heretic because he spoke so clearly and beautifully on the non-existence of demand between from this and that. But still you find there is a trace of a reference to this and that. And also equally if you read teachings of Maharshi from the Hindu point of view, that we still find there is some reference to this and that. If you look at from a general point of view, you might find the like the Master Eckhart or Maharshi are saying the same thing as what Buddhism is trying to teach. Same time, there is a tremendous room and egolessness and a tremendous spaciousness and kindness involved with the whole thing. But if you look behind the stage, so to speak, if you look closely, further and further, and where the source of devotion is come from, why spirituality is because there's a divine principle that's involved there, therefore we could integrate ourselves to this. And by doing so, then we begin to develop non-ego of some kind. And precisely we have the what's known as the Integral Yoga Institute organized by Swami Sachidananda, which integral part is that bringing God in you, and therefore the you and the God have no differences. You are God, God and you. And in Indian terms it's called Bhagwan, in Judeo-Christian tradition called God. There is that kind of emphasis on integrating the possibilities necessary for it, which makes, if you want to integrate something, if you say united something, which doesn't mean to say completely one, if you say united, there is something to unite it with, otherwise you don't have a word united at all. So that and this is a one, but still makes it two. That's the word united or union means, that in order to have a union, you have to have a other and this to union with. So oneness means the zero and one brought together. There is a still split and reference point in any case, which is a basic theistic tradition, which seem to be no particular problem. We are not attacking them necessarily, but we are not confirming them either. On the other hand, that we are talking in terms of where the attitude comes from of spirituality altogether. In the theistic traditions, the attitude comes from because there exists, and then this exists, and therefore that or there is the greater and fantastic, majestic, splendid, and this is so much suffered in the turmoil. So this small should dissolve into that and that, and therefore there comes into us. So in turn we could become also there as greater. So the vision comes from there first, then obviously selflessness and anything, generosity and anything comes from this in order to match that. It's like what we call it, a matching fundraise. If you have $100,000 already in your bank account, then you go to another foundation and say, look, we have $100,000 in our bank account. Would you match that in order to put our project in on the way? And that particular kind of type approach. Situation. And I'm afraid I'm speaking very simply at this point. Then we have the discussion on the non-theism at this point. And particularly we are talking at this point on this course in terms of Mahayana principles. The Mahayana principle is based on non-theistic tradition, obviously, as its previous foundation of the Mahayana at all, which is known as the Hinayana, which is called a lesser vehicle. Yana meaning vehicle, Maha meaning big or great, giant, and Hina meaning lesser, and Yana meaning vehicle, again. From the Hinayana point of view, that there is a notion of developing a belittling of our existence. And from the Buddhist point of view, that we don't look for any divine principles to help us particularly at all. To begin with, always begin with what we have here. And we find ourselves, if we find ourselves in a situation where there's no telephone, there's no newspaper, there's no television to watch, and if we find ourselves in a just purely Gobi desert in the middle of it, and what usually shall we do? What usually we do? We usually sit and get bored, and we begin to explore our own resources. That is to say, we have our body, we have our speech, we have our mind. And we begin to work with that basic principles that we simply hear. There's no source of entertainment to distract us. And we have just simply our body, mind, and our speech. So the Mahayana principle, Hinayana principle, the lesser vehicle begins from that particular principle, that particular approach, by realizing that we cannot use any of the rest of the entertainments, but we have to maintain and work with ourselves to begin with. It's a question of what is known as individual salvation, which is a technical term. In the Sanskrit, it's known as the pratimoksha. We don't pray, we don't look for any help, except help of the elder, which is the teacher who knew and who had already that kind of education already. We just seek for elder, teacher. And within the instruction of the teacher, we simply are trying to work with what we have without inviting any grand tours from upstairs, and simply here and there. And to begin with, what's known is we practice shamatha discipline, that is sitting practice meditation, by using what we have, that is to say, when we exist as human beings, we have our body, we have our mind, which thinks a lot, and we have our breath in order to maintain our body and keep our hearts beating. So that's only resources we have altogether. So we take advantage of that, which is a typical non-theistic style of working with a religious practice. If we can call it religion at all, it's more of just basic functioning. How we could function and how we can actually relate it with ourselves to begin with, very simply, directly. And at the same time, we have a chaos in our marriage, in the finance, social situations, jobs, and all sorts of problems comes up. But nonetheless, in spite of those problems, we just simply trying to sit and breathe. And one begins to develop a tremendous concentration of a mind in working with, following the breath, and simply being there on the dot, on the spot, and simplifying everything that exists around us, that we try to naturally go along with the physical availabilities, how much we can actually exert ourselves, and what particular situations we can use, which is po- posture, we can sit like the Buddha. That much we can do. Unless we are extraordinarily invalid, have problems in the back and our leg, unless you are in a wheelchair, everybody is capable of sitting on a cushion. Lower ourselves down, have a connection with earth, sit, breathe, and concentrate on the movements of the breath. It's very basic, very basic. And nothing is coming from above or below. That's the epitome of non-theism, how to become holy from the means of non-theism, is trying to be very literal, which is interesting, twisted, grace which rule. The holiness comes from practicality, this point. And there is no showering with blessings, and there's nothing particularly happening. There's no tongues talking, and there's no whispering in the ear, and there's no praying to help anybody. And we just do it. Sit on cushion and just do it. And what is available to us, which is what we might call it naturalism, that you might appreciate a stream, you might appreciate the greenery, you might appreciate the clouds and sunshine and the blue sky. That's what we have around us. And this non-theism project, so to speak, is the same thing. It's simply what you have, and we work on that, basically. And which is very ordinary, very basic. And out of that, we begin to develop further process. Sometimes there's possibilities that we might actually fall in love with what we are doing and we forget anything else. So this point, that there is an idea of the Mahayana notion of being aware and truly being on the dot, on the spot, is something else. Which you begin to realize that we are incapable of falling in love. At large, traditionally speaking, you are not supposed to fall in love with the rest of the world, but you're supposed to fall in love with the one particular partner that was chosen to be your spouse, and it's supposed to be faithful. It's a basic idea of Protestant ethic, or even Catholic ethic, as we know. But here, the avenues opened greater, that because you can concentrate on what you have in your system, and you can work with your breath, you can be simple and direct, and so disciplined that way, of the Hinayana style, and then you're supposed to have capability is risen higher, that your particular faculty of your emotional system is being opened greater. That you should have this particular energy in you that you can fall in love with the entire world. That is the essence of the Mahayana teaching, and in traditional terms, it is known as the Karuna. K-R-U-N-A. In the Tibetan, it's called Nyingje, which is spelled N-Y-I-N-G-J-E. Nying meaning heart. G-A-J meaning a noble, so it's noble heart. And the Karuna means basically a higher level of emotion, basically the gentle emotion that one can express to others. The Mahayana tradition is always encourages us that we will develop that kind of a bigger heart, that we don't just reduce our fondness and love affair to purely one person alone, but expand to the entire world. The traditional teaching, which says that use your mother as example, and since you have affection to your mother, and then you can expand that type of affection to the rest of the sentient beings, everybody who likes you, who may not like you, who are indifferent. That possibilities of expanding greater mind. And at that point, the religiousness begin to come in some sense. We can't exactly call it holy from the point of view of the theism of being blessed by God particularly, but it is sacred and holy because it is such noble idea that we begin to decide to actually give an inch and give a mile to others, which we have never done in our lives, mostly. And we always try to hold some little territory, always. And this point is that giving out that grudge or resentment, anything at all, just begin to flow out our heart, which seems to be one of the basic principles of Mahayana ideal, Mahayana doctrine altogether. And when we begin to do that, we also begin to find that there is an after effect of that, that is to say, that when we begin to let go of our territorialism and our holding back of our territory and so forth, we begin to develop what's known as that free from klesha. Klesha is a Sanskrit word which means neurotic tendencies of all kinds, aggression, passion, ignorance, arrogance, envy, jealousy of all kinds, that we are able to overcome those. Because why those thoughts occurred in our system altogether is because that for greatest reason is we want to hold our own territory. And therefore, in order to maintain our territory, we had to be tough with somebody. We had to invite somebody to entertain us, which is aggression and passion. And we also have to declare ourselves, which is arrogance and pride. And then we have to also have a debate with somebody else, which is jealousness. And in order to maintain ourselves, we have a stinginess, miserliness, and so forth. A lot of the klesha in Sanskrit word, which means that, literally it means that which makes us in pain. So maintaining this, holding the fort of ego, it takes a lot of pain and pressure, and we suffer so much. But when we gain little inch from somewhere, by putting out a mile of energy, we feel so gratified. That is the usually what's known as samsaric world or insane world works. So that seems to be one of the basic principles that we're trying to overcome. Not only cuts our neurosis alone, but also we begin to develop a fearlessness, that we begin to realize that we have nothing to lose if we open ourselves to others and we're going to work with others. Let go of our reservations of that kind, of preserving our ego altogether, that we begin to become helpful to others, which is the ideal Mahayana conduct and hope that everybody would be able to help others, each one of us. So those are the three type of situation. So to begin with, the idea that giving in, which is a very important and extraordinary powerful move that any human beings can make is a fantastic and a glorious, majestic move that giving in, giving up, giving in the territory. Second, able to overcome our neurosis. Thirdly, that we become resourceful in helping others. So those are the three possibilities, three principles that actually, on the whole, that Mahayana principle is trying to achieve. So that seems to be the basic point. Without boring you further, maybe you can ask questions if you like, please.
I remember correctly, you mentioned that a person could not be helpful to someone else until, unless they weren't a nuisance to them. Now, if someone continued to give in to the point where, let's say, their livelihood was threatened, and then they became dependent upon someone else to the point where they were a nuisance, how would one relate with a situation like that?
Well, that's a good one. I think what we talked about tonight is the number one and number two are developing one's own individual discipline. So that is the so that you don't become a nuisance to others. The openness, cutting through clashes, are the developing oneself so that you don't become a nuisance to others. So you have your own discipline happening. And also, beyond that, there is a tremendous practice and study in Hinayana discipline of shamatha practice by taming oneself, training oneself completely thoroughly. And then the third category we talked about tonight is that at that point we are perfectly certain that you wouldn't be nuisance to others and you will be helpful to others at that point. That's how it goes. And we will discuss further, of course, the bodhisattva vows and paramitas and everything later on as we go along. Young lady, over there.
Hi, I've been experiencing a little difficulty and confusion about openness, where I've had cases in my life where people, when I open myself up or feel like I'm doing that anyway, people come in and they become what someone else said, a nuisance or something like that. My natural reaction to them is to close, you know, and say, I don't want this in my space. And I experience a lot of pain in remaining open, but also wonder if there's some type of intelligence that's involved with that closing also.
Well, I think the main point is that one doesn't just purely open without preparation. One has to know how to open. It's, you know, basically speaking, openness is a tremendous threat to particularly modern men. If somebody opened to you, if somebody spoke and began to have a dialogue in while you were on the train or the, in the bus, and sharing a taxi together, and they get terrified because they want to have their own entertainment, which is something else which preoccupies their mind. And they don't want to be talked into. And often if you eat in the restaurant together and you can't talk to the next table, it spoils their entertainment altogether. And it's they're afraid and they don't want to. They just want to have their personal familiar world rotate around 24 hours a day, and that's their world, and you don't want to be extended to any other. And that is why the advertisements of all sorts of things happens on the television, on the posters. Whenever the business people come up with a new merchandise, they have to really say what they are. They're not going to interfere with their family life. That's the whole concept, in a nutshell, of advertisement. Is that main point is that they're not going to interfere with their domestic situation. And therefore, it is going to be helpful to your domestic situation. And if you watch every one of them, like ad for coffee or drinking coffee or ad for this and that, you know. It always says that somebody has a problem and their husband has a problem and the wife discovered a coffee. And then it says, ah! So everything's within the family joke. So that's the whole point and the whole problem there is the territory. And I think in order to relate with somebody, in the openness is also, there's a lot of need for individual discipline. That your openness is not so much of a, sometimes they regard it as an attack. You see, you say, hi, I'm open. So we have to come out with a, some kind of discipline. And that's why the idea of Hinayana, the principle of sitting practice, is very much necessary to prepare the ground so when we begin to open, it doesn't become an attack. And it's a natural situation. It's almost like planting in a garden. It's organic, so that way. So that's why that there's need for three on the journey, basically speaking. Thank you. Gentlemen,
you mentioned at the beginning of the talk that there were certain religions which were theistic and had a god which played a certain role, and that Buddhism was non-theistic. And my question was, is the role of the guru in Buddhism similar to that of the god in a theistic religion, or if not, what is the role?
Well, I would say quite flatly, actually, that's very simple. The principle of a guru is a doctor, surgeon, opposed to there's ideal healthyhood, that you might have Muhammad Ali or somebody there, and you want to attain that. And the doctor is not that. And the guru principle is just a patient can relate with that particular problems, sickness. It's a high-powered surgeon and heavy-handed doctor. And that seemed to be the only way, you know. It's you can follow the examples of a guru, and you can study with a guru, but the guru is not exactly that of an ideal goal, but at the same point. But on the other hand, guru is the principle of a reference point where realizing that 2,500 years of lineage is handed down up to present guru, that they are unbroken and genuine altogether. So it has that genuineness of it as well. But guru is not particularly regarded as a hero worshipable principle at all.
Thank you.
Ravishay, I have a question about the chants that we do and about theism. I understand that the essential difference between Buddhism and most other traditions is its non-theism. Yet it seems, on the face of it at least, some of the chants that we do are overtly theistic. I'm thinking in particular of the Protector chant and the Mahakali chant.
Yeah.
Would you perhaps illuminate the non-theism in these chants?
Well, I think the basic point is that awareness had to be invoked. And that's where the protection principle comes in. We are not particularly asking that the basic point is that purity and impurity in the Judeo-Christian tradition that human beings made original mistake and offended God. And so we begin to develop original sin. And we're trying to pay them off by trying to be good. And that doesn't exist. And also, on the other hand, in the non-theistic tradition, is that we deserve what we have, and we are practitioners, therefore we generate our energy and power and strength. Therefore we are recreating our own energy on the spot. So it's more of a personal manufacturing energy and strength on the spot, rather than feeling bad or good about anything. That's one. And another principle is obviously the idea of Sugata Garbha, Buddha nature, and Bodhicitta that exists in us. We have a right to open ourselves, reworking all those. And if there's any obstacles, goes with it, that we crush them because we are going to open ourselves anyway. So the idea is the flower will blossom when the sun rises, not. So that kind of idea for we are about to extend our vision on the spot. So the obstacles be undermined rather than praying somebody to shovel your snow on your front door.
Thank you.
Gentleman over there?
Rinpoche, there seems to be a great possibility, if not tendency, to imitate giving up territory and imitate being resourceful of helping people, which is obviously ego reinforcement. And I wonder if you just should somehow stop yourself doing that and go back to basic practice, or if you give it a try again and again?
Well, two types of imitations, or aping, we could say. First one is imitation with the ego, which is aping the Buddha. And the other type is following the example and hold posture like the Buddha and sit cross-legged and meditate, which is necessary. If we don't do that, we don't have any enlightenment. So it seems to be two types of situations of aping and what's the other word? Emulating, yes. Aping and emulating. We have to mimic the Buddha, nonetheless. We have to sit and have a good posture, a good head and shoulder. We have to spark out brilliance, which is emulating the Buddha. But if you begin to think that we're going to impress somebody else other than us, or we want to cultivate leadership, or we want to become a holy man, then you begin to become a fake prophet.
How does the emulating work as opposed to aping in relating to people?
If you begin to speak out of your experience to people, that's emulating. If you begin to speak out to people of what you think you would like to be, then you become fake.
Thank you.
At that point, we could stop here at this point. I would like to encourage people to practice this point. We have a practice schedules and space is formed. And if we are going to study properly of the basic Buddha Dharma altogether, that without a certain amount of sitting practice, we probably have a tremendous problem in understanding it. So I would like to encourage all of you to work on your practice as much as you can. And also we have a discussion situation set up. And please join us as much as you can so that you begin to have some kind of feeling of what we are trying to sing. And I begin to feel that one talk by myself or my regent is not quite going to be enough. But we have to have a seasoning of all of you if you want to take this course, if you want to understand this course altogether at all, that we have to relate with other situations of sitting practice and discussion groups and other things like that. It's going to be very helpful to you. And once more, as the first day of Naropa Institute in my particular course, I would like to invite and welcome all of you. And it's so good to see all of you here. And we appreciate it very much. And please maintain your genuineness. Thank you so much.